All right, so any discussion coming up? Again, I went through it pretty thoroughly. I think what I did, this Indian philosophical school, which says that all things come from a general, that's how it's just translated into English. I'm not sure if this is a proper English term, but things arise from this unspecified thing or substance or principle, which in general gives rise to everything. It's not sentient. It's just that gives rise. I think what I caught from what Dorji was saying about specific and general is specific is, I think, Steve, you got this specific excludes, like things arising from themselves, from the, I think that's what he was saying. Did anybody else get that? You weren't here last night. Why not? All right, so I think that was, but I'm not sure, because it went so quickly. And I'm half deaf, so I only catch half the words. But I think that was what he was talking about, distinguishing between a general thing giving rise to whatever exists and specific, like our own five aggregates giving rise to themselves.
That was a question about
something
particular or something general,
isn't it? Yeah. I mean, all of those points were refuting particular schools of philosophy in India at the time of Buddha. And since everyone had the same problem, that they all talked about the cause as being permanent. So the Buddhists have the one rejection of them all, saying something which is permanent, which is meaning unchanging, cannot be a cause, because a cause necessarily changes in giving rise to a result.
That was in the context of the creator God too, wasn't it? Because
because they that's right. The concept of it. Well, we translate it again as God, but this being, this time is a sentient being, but who is unchanging. And so the refutation always goes back, well, permanent things can't give rise to results, which got a bit boring after a while. The classic, the four-point analysis, and that's one of many meditations anyway, but that's the classic one, is to first try to generate the appearance of the eye as an inherently or truly existing phenomenon. So like we did this morning, you imagine a situation where maybe you're criticized or you're praised or whatever, and there's this strong sense of I arises, as I'm the one being blamed or criticized, I'm the one being praised, right? So there's this strong sense of I. Then when we generate this inner awareness of how I appear to my mind, how my I appears to my mind, then, you see, we have to be sure of what it is which is to be negated, right? in emptiness. Emptiness is a negation of a truly existing I. So by reflecting in meditation on a situation where the strong sense of I arises, then we look at that sense of I, not in a, how do you say, not in a way of exclusion, but just trying to see the appearance. And we know that from our teachings that the I that exists is merely imputed on the body and mind, but it exists nowhere on the body and mind. It's just merely imputed. So that's the I which exists. The I which doesn't exist is the sense of an I abiding in relationship to the body and mind. Not particularly body, not particularly mind, but definitely in here, of me, you know. Why do we point to our chest? So we have to try to recognize the appearance of a truly existing I, right? An unchanging me. It's the same me that's been here, you know, since the beginning or since I was born, and get an idea of such an appearance. Having generated some understanding of how the mistaken I, the wrong I, a truly existing I appears to our mind, then we think, okay, then if I do exist in the way I think I exist, the way I appear to exist, then is it part of the body or the mind, or the body and mind, or is it separate from the body and mind? So we do this under the logical understanding that if something can only exist in one of two places, if it cannot be found in either of those two places, then it does not exist. So the two places, an truly existing I, the same as body and mind, or within body and mind, or separate, unconnected to body and mind. So we don't negate the appearance of a truly existing I immediately. We say, all right, if I exist this way, then where am I in body, in mind? Can't find it there, must be separate from the body and mind. So we look for something which exists independently of the body and mind. And there's nothing there either, because whenever we refer to a person, we always refer to some physical or mental quality. So the conclusion is, truly existing I does not exist. That's the classic way to meditate on emptiness.
So, in the rejection of the eye.
Rejection?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but you have to choose your words carefully. Meditation on emptiness is not rejection of the I. It is rejection of an inherently existing I, which has never existed. It does not reject the merely imputed I, which does exist. We've got to distinguish between those two. You see, in the morning's meditation, the purpose or the point was to understand that whenever we are upset, we are the cause of our being upset is false, because we are grasping at a truly existing me, or truly existing enemy, or truly existing friends, or truly existing possessions, etc., etc. If we had the wisdom, understanding emptiness of true existence, our mind could never be upset. That's why I said in the meditation, that knowledge and wisdom is like an aura of total protection against problems. Well, mental problems. Because sticks and stones can still break our bones even if we understand emptiness. But names can never hurt me because we understand them to be... There is nothing which catches that name.
Right? We can't find it, that
enemy can't
either.
So?
If we can't find I.
If we can't find the inherently existing I, we can find the I.
Yes, our enemies can't find the I, so they can't attack
us. But it doesn't matter. They still believe we're inherently existing. It's a really important point, because the danger is that we negate the merely imputed I, and that's when meditation on emptiness can give us a bit of a scare, that we negate too much. We have to find the balance or the middle way of neither, you know, eternal existence or nihilistic non-existence. Well, it depends. I can't remember the context where he used them. But knowledge, like both intelligence and wisdom, belong to the family of knowledge, right? So there are three levels of knowledge. There's the knowledge of hearing, listening and reading, and then there's the knowledge of analysis on the meaning of what we've heard and what we've read, and then there's the knowledge of meditation. So often the meditational knowledge is called wisdom because it's much more profound, and when we get direct understanding, it's the non-intellectual direct awareness of reality, whereas intelligence probably covers the first two types of knowledge, hearing and listening and analytical reasoning. But they're all the same family. You know, and meditational knowledge can be inferential, where you understand it through perfect, unassailable logic. And then there's the supreme wisdom of direct realization, which sees things, you go beyond inference, you see it directly. And that's what we're aiming for. But to get there, we have to go through the step of inferential knowledge or wisdom. Uh, I think it covers every sphere of learning, you know, philosophical or even learning how to do a craft or whatever. You have those three levels of understanding. You know, masters of craft can do things so effortlessly, almost spontaneously. Whereas the apprentices can only do it inferentially, and beginners mess up the job. The last verse and the next verse, 52 and 53, really referring to the three higher trainings. Well, here it says superior discipline, superior wisdom, and superior mind. So this refers to the three higher trainings of morality, of wisdom, and concentration. Superior mind is concentration. So the cultivation of these three higher trainings is emphasized in relation to the Four Noble Truths, is emphasized in the Hinayana Path, the lesser vehicle. Again, I said, but also we should expand this to think of the Bodhisattva's path to enlightenment, which includes the three higher trainings, but in a more expanded into the six perfections. So what would they be? Generosity and patience and morality would be morality. Maybe enthusiastic perseverance also is morality. So that's the first four of the six perfections. And then concentration is concentration, and wisdom is wisdom. And again, I emphasize the point in the previous verse, the sequential cultivation of study, you know, learning of ethics or discipline. So, in order to really engage in morality or ethics or self-discipline, restraint from non-virtue, you've got to have a reason. And so that reason is the first, the study or the learning. Like some people might just take vows because other people do. They have no understanding of karma or reincarnation, and so they sort of take a vow. So that vow is incredibly weak because there's no real reason for them to do it. They just do it because it's a fad. Well, you know, others do it. So we need, in order like to take vows, to take refuge, and the refuge vows, or to become ordained as a monk or a nun, then it's essential to have thorough grounding of the general teachings, which will then give one the enthusiasm and the energy to take a vow and really engage in restraint from non-virtue. And then concentration means remaining focused upon the vows we've taken, and that adds further and further strength to maintaining those vows. So that was what Genlar emphasized this morning. So study or learning, ethics, and concentration in that order shows our practice. You know, I've even observed, like some people, particularly in the early days, would become ordained as a monk or a nun because they're the first Sangha, they're a very strong looking group of monks and nuns and with very little background meditation in Lum Rim, they would take vows, but they don't last very long because they haven't established a foundation of deep understanding of karma and the reason for taking vows. And so, and they definitely have no concentration, so they might take the vows, but they're very lax in keeping the vows because of lack of understanding. So they lose the vows, they give them up or they break them. Any points in general, or do we have a early cup of tea? The five aggregates. It's just scientific.
It is scientific. Yes.
I mean, aggregate or collection is the translation of the Sanskrit word skanda. That's it. So, collection is aggregate, heap, a heap of composed of different things. Right? No, that's just where the name comes from. So in a sutra, Buddha was teaching the what is a human being? Right? So a human being is a sentient being who looks like us, looks and thinks like us. That's a human being. And he said we can, so there's a body and there's a mind. There's no third thing, such as a soul which is neither body nor mind. A human being is just a composite of body and mind. So, in the sutra that he explained in detail, he got a bowl of mixed grains of rice and wheat and barley and whatever, and he put one heap, one skanda on the table. This represents the form aggregate, the physical aggregate, right? The body. So then he explained that the body is composed of many different limbs, organs, at a gross level, bones, etc. And then at a more subtle level, there's the sensitive, the physical, nerves which are sensitive to sensory stimuli, the retina, the auditory part of the ear, the cochlea and all that stuff, taste buds, smell and tactile touch. So that is part of the body, the sensory powers or sensory equipment. Then a more subtle level, which you didn't teach in the sutra, is the subtle winds and channels which make up the more subtle aspect of the body. Okay? So that's many different things, and that's the form aggregate. And it could go into it in great detail, even talk about the objects of the senses, like colours and shapes, in an expanded way. Even the external objects of the senses are included in the form aggregate. I mean, they're not part of a human being, but the expanded presentation includes colours and shapes, sounds, smells, tastes and tangibles. Okay, so that's the first heap. Then the second heap, within, so the next four are in the mind. Right? They are the mind. They are the entire presentation of mind. So mind has the six primary or main types of consciousness: eye consciousness, ear consciousness, you know, smell, taste, touch, and mental consciousness is our sixth sense of where we think and have emotions, so on. So that's the fifth aggregate, the six types of consciousness. It's an aggregate because there are six different types of consciousness. Collectively, they're all mind, but they're set, you can define them separately. Eye consciousness only perceives colours and shapes. It doesn't perceive sounds or smells or touch. And, you know, same for the other part. So there's, that remains three more aggregates. So the number two aggregate is the aggregate of feelings. So feeling in Buddhism specifically refers not just to emotions in general, but the feelings of happiness, unhappiness, and neutral feeling. And this can be physical pleasure, physical pain, or physical neutral feeling, or mental happiness, mental in the mental consciousness, mental unhappiness, and mental neutral feeling. So there's six types of feeling. There's a heap of different feelings. Why? Out of all of the various factors of the mind, why did Buddha select feelings? Because it is the pursuit of pleasure and avoidance of pain are the main source of dispute amongst ordinary people. The next, the third aggregate of discriminations. So discrimination is the, belongs to the family of knowledge. That's where we can discriminate between this and that. You know, we have some understanding of this, to distinguish between different things. So that's vast, you know. There are so many areas of awareness where we distinguish between what is one thing, what belongs to one category, and what belongs to another category, and so on. So Buddha taught that. That's just one activity of mind. Buddha taught that because discriminations are the main source of dispute amongst ordained people. Then the fourth aggregate is all the other mental factors, mental qualities. So these are divided, they're presented in one division of 51. If you want to go into more deeply, there are 84,000, but 51. So there are, these are just factors of mind that occur simultaneously with their associated primary consciousness, and they're involved in the way we apprehend things. So there's the first five, just in general, whenever we are aware of something, first there's the mental function or mental activity of intention. Intention is where the mind generates an urge to become involved in something, to see, smell, taste, touch, or think about something. So intention, and then there is contact of the mind with the object, and then there's feeling, but we've already had feeling, that's the second aggregate, and there's discrimination, that's the third aggregate, and there's engagement. The mind, having sought its object of interest, engages with the object. Those, apart from feelings and discriminations, the other three ever-present mental factors are belong in the fourth aggregate. Then there's six root non-virtues, or six root afflictions. There are 20 secondary afflictions. There are 11 virtuous mental factors. Faith, non-anger, non-attachment, non-ignorance, consideration of others, and so on. So all of those are collected in the fourth aggregate. So that's a brief, that's what the aggregates are. Yeah, I mean, it's just for us, it's just a new way of looking at things, but it's pretty basic. And that includes everything. And what's absent or missing from, in terms of everything that exists, what is absent from the five aggregates is permanent phenomena. So all of the five aggregates are impermanent, they change moment by moment. So the five aggregates, although whatever exists, its ultimate nature is emptiness, emptiness of inherent existence, which is permanent, that doesn't change moment by moment. That phenomenon, or all permanent phenomena, are not included in the five aggregates. But everything else, whatever exists, is there. Yeah.
So, in the aggregates, I thought that discriminating awareness was the discrimination that the eyes see colour, the ears hear the sound, or that's not it.
Well, in terms of the eye consciousness, it would just be the sense consciousnesses don't apply labels. But eye consciousness knows the difference between red and yellow. We're not talking about colorblind people. It is just this awareness that red and yellow, and you know, the different colors are different from each other and different shapes. It knows, but it doesn't apply the label triangle, circle, square. That is done by mental consciousness. That's discrimination in the mental consciousness.
I got that wrong.
Oh, well, you didn't get it wrong, you're just trying to work it out. Which is what we have to do. What Buddha said, check up. I mean, for us, the term discrimination has a negative connotation. You know, you discriminate against something or someone with a negative mind, but that's not the meaning in this context. Yeah.
Then, what
about a spiritual friend or a lama, or, I mean, although it's up to us, no one gets there without making the effort. Yeah.
But,
well, I mean, as it says in the first line, freedom, you know, liberation from samsara depends upon us alone. The Buddhas, who are the best spiritual friends, can only show us the way. They can't take us by the hand and lead us to liberation. Only we, see, that's something that we can do the Buddhists can't do. We can liberate ourselves, but Buddhists can't liberate us. So Buddhas are omniscient, but they're not omnipotent. As Gernot said, if they could, they would, because they have universal love and compassion. And this is so much a criticism of the Judeo-Christian God, who is said to be omnipotent and all-loving. Then why does, if he has that power, why does he or she allow such suffering to happen? Well, my discrimination says it's time for a cup of tea. Unless there's something else. No. All right.